Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean to learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi, a PhD candidate at Princeton University. Today we are here to talk to Dr. Philip Gooding, a postdoctoral fellow at the Indian Ocean World Center at McGill University, Montreal, Canada. We will be talking about his edited volume, Droughts, Floods, and Global Climatic Anomalies in the Indian Ocean World, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2022, within a series in the Indian Ocean World Studies. The book Droughts, Floods, and Global Climatic Anomalies explores histories of droughts and floods in the Indian Ocean world and their connections to broader global climatic anomalies. It deploys an interdisciplinary approach rooted in the emerging field of climate history to investigate the multifaceted effects of global climatic anomalies on regions affected by the Indian Ocean monsoon system, which is regularly conceived the macro regions of deep structure, which we will be talking about later today. Case studies explore how droughts and floods related to anomalous climatic conditions have historically affected states, societies, and ecologies across the Indian Ocean world, including in relation to food security, epidemic diseases, political stability and instability, economic change, infrastructural development, colonialism, capitalism, and scientific knowledge. Tracing long-durée patterns from the 12th to the early 20th centuries, this book makes a significant contribution to our understanding of global climatic events and their effects on the Indian Ocean world. It highlights essential historical cases and studies for contextualizing the potential effects of global warming on the macro region in the present and future. Welcome, Philip, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about the edited volume.
Thanks very much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here again.
The pleasure is all mine. We would like first to learn about you. So can you start us off by saying a few words about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in the Indian Ocean world, and any influential mentors that you had along the way?
Sure. Yeah. So I am originally British, and I did all my schooling in the UK. I studied mostly African history at the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, at the University of London. And I did that in my BA, MA, and PhD. And very much so throughout my early schooling, PhD isn't really early schooling anymore, but throughout that process, I was focusing mostly just on Africa. My PhD thesis, which has now turned into a book, which I've also had an interview about for the New Books Network, that's On the Frontiers of the Indian Ocean World, in the History of Lake Tanganyika. That originally all was kind of focus within from an Africanist state, an Africanist point of view, and that was born out just out of a broad interest in the region that I kind of continued throughout my studies. My kind of interests, my kind of broadening of my horizons out of kind of this lake region or the Great Lakes region of Africa, which is quite a long way from the Indian Ocean in terms of distance, really came about through migrating to Montreal and embedding myself and eventually having a postdoctoral fellowship at the Indian Ocean World Center, which is headed by Professor Gwyn Campbell. And this kind of process of coming to the Indian Ocean World Center, engaging with scholars focusing on Madagascar, on firstly Madagascar and the Mascarene Islands, but then also thinking even further afield, the Arabian Peninsula into South Asia as well, especially, made me think about not just thinking about my case study focusing on Lake Tanganyika as part of from an Africanist perspective, but also thinking on a much wider macro, much wider spatial scale. The kind of underpinning philosophy behind all this is that what I've always been trying to do with my historical research is answer the question, well, so what? And by what I mean by that is not just give kind of a really detailed history of my region and time period that I'm a specialist in, but also trying to understand how that influences and sits in with wider narratives that operate at a world scale. And originally, when I was thinking about Lake Tanganyika, I was thinking mostly just around how does understanding this kind of narrow, very large lake, but narrow kind of area study, how does that help us understand the wider region of East Africa in the 19th century? What I actually came to realize, however, is that I could actually have a much wider temporal scale by engaging with the Indian Ocean world. A wider spatial scale by engaging with the Indian Ocean world. And thinking about the kind of the wider influences, both on Lake Tanganyika in terms of an Indian Ocean world history, but also Lake Tanganyika's influence in terms of how we understand the wider Indian Ocean world as well. So once I'd got that kind of interest and kind of thought about that wider spatial scale, I tried to kind of understand more and more about what it is, what comprises the Indian Ocean world, what is it that makes it a distinct world? And as all listeners to this podcast will know, some of the foundational works on this from a historical perspective, thinking, of course, works by Chowdhury, by McPherson, by Pearson, all these works all really refer to the Indian Ocean monsoon system or the Asian monsoon system as kind of the key unifier, although I suppose unity is something that is sometimes queried, the key structure, the deep structure, for using Pearson's terms, that binds the Indian Ocean together and links it all together in terms of its connections. And kind of this book, this edited volume, Droughts, Floods, and Global Climatic Anomalies in the Indian Ocean World, came about partly to, firstly, to understand what is it that makes the regions around the Indian Ocean a distinct world. So engaging this kind of engaging with these foundational works, but then moving beyond that and actually trying to really assess what are the characteristics of the Asian monsoon system and how has it affected the wider Indian Ocean. One of the things that I think a lot of the foundational works is that they take the Indian Ocean monsoon system as kind of as a given, as an annual back and forth. And this kind of builds on some of Fernand Braudel's core ideas about kind of an unchanging environmental context that binds the Indian Ocean world an unchanging environmental context that binds world histories. Now, what I wanted to really interrogate here is actually suggest, and I think the introduction and the chapters, when you consider them collectively, really achieve this, is that actually, you know, this underpinning environmental context is subject to a lot of variability. Yes, the winds may change direction annually or every 6 months, enabling commercial and cultural connections around the international world. But if we think about it in terms of rainfall instead, rainfall is subject to a lot of variability. So that's kind of where, how I got interested in the topic. And that's where the inspiration behind this book came from, is really trying to understand what makes the regions around the international world comprise distinct world, and what are the characteristics of the structures of the deep structure that makes those connections. And it was to kind of really suggest ways in which that it's a highly variable phenomenon.
Thank you for sharing this very informative overview of the Indian Ocean field and your connection to it. Can you say a few words about your own mentors who shaped your thinking on the field?
So in relation to that, Professor Gwyn Campbell's work has been pretty influential. This book itself came about through it was originally supposed to be a conference, which was scheduled for May 2020, which was, of course, cancelled because of the outbreak of COVID. And that conference was meant to be an output for the Indian Ocean World Centre's Appraising Risk, Past and Present partnership project, which is funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. And despite not having a conference, we still pushed through towards publication with combining some of the scholars who are due to present at the conference, and then adding, then basically approaching some people who are engaged with the partnership, with the International World Centre's partnership project. That partnership project, so this obviously has a lot of mentors in it, and this kind of comes through in the contents page. For example, Angela Schottenhammer and James Francis Warren are heavily involved with the partnership project, as well as Professor Gwyn Campbell. And this project is designed or intended to assess six periods of environmental stress in the past of the Indian Ocean world, for periods of between 20 and 40 years, the Indian Ocean monsoon system appears to have created particularly adverse climates for people across the Indian Ocean world. The earliest one being in the 6th century CE, and the most recent one being the one that we're currently experiencing. So in terms of the mentors that really influenced that, is really the major contributors to this partnership project. So that's Professor Gwyn Campbell, who's the PI, and then Angela Schottenhammer, Jim Warren, who also wrote papers or chapters for this edited volume.
Thank you. I would like to ask you about this paradox between historians acknowledging the centrality of the monsoon system in the Indian Ocean, but at the same time, we find that climate history comes quite late to the historiography. How do you explain that?
It's such a very interesting question, and this is going to, and anything I'm going to answer to that is quite speculative. I think there has been a reluctance, particularly in the late 20th century, to engage with the variability of the monsoon system because of a fear of climate determinism. And I can refer to this especially in terms of Africanist history. There was a period in the kind of the, particularly following the independence movements and the origins of African history, there was, and I'm referring to some foundational journal articles by William Beinart and James McCann, which were published around 2000-2001 here, where they kind of acknowledge that there's a reluctance among many historians of Africa, and I assume this applies to the wider Indian Ocean world to some degree as well, to engage with climate as a driving factor behind history, behind historical processes, because during the colonial period and early European contacts with Africa, there was a lot of climatic determinism in imperial thinking, and there's these racial tropes about among imperialist thinking, which kind of saw the which equated harsh environments, so environments that Europeans struggled to survive in because of lack of immunity to tropical diseases, and what they saw as factors that contributed to them being more civilized than people and societies of color. So I think there was kind of, particularly in the 20th century, there, because of this kind of long-term colonial legacy, I see an uneasiness in the historiography, particularly of Africa, to engage with climate as an important factor in the continent's history, simply because it was difficult to disentangle a climate-focused history from the narratives of colonialism. Now, I think that paradigm is in the process of shifting. And they're finding new ways to engage in climate. And this is definitely a response to the current challenges of global warming, where I think it's seen as increasingly integral and increasingly important to think about climate and its effects on history, but also at the same time to acknowledge its colonial past and to do it in ways that are different to the ways that Europeans did in the late 19th and early 20th century. So that would be kind of my speculation. I do wonder about the wider Indian Ocean, why it might not have impacted so much. Of course, some regions have like a longer tradition of climate history, China being the most obvious one, where there's been a lot of documentary research since the 1970s at least, and probably before, where climate has been, where kind of climatic variations have been kind of charted and looked at in official gazetteers and have been analyzed as a result. But also one of the other factors that probably has limited it for the limited kind of focusing on the variability in the foundational studies might be because of lack of data and the difficulty of accessing data that can kind of suggest wide climatic variabilities on a big scale across the Indian Ocean. I think historians would naturally want to look for this kind of data in, or would previously have wanted to look for this kind of data in archives. This is the kind of material that we're most familiar with, which means if you're going to look for a kind of large, broad scale climatic variations, that means you've got to look at a lot of archives, and that requires a lot of work. Whereas now, with things like the Global Historical Climate Network, which has compiled all the known rain gauge data, which goes back to the for some regions goes back to the early 19th century, that's all freely available online now. We also have things like global climatic models, which help us to kind of project what might have been the effects of certain like El Nino events. And this wasn't available to scholars writing in the 1980s, but it is now. So a combination of trying to, so to answer your kind of a question in a very in kind of three broad points, I think a willingness to engage in climate as a factor now that we're trying to move beyond colonialist paradigms about the role of climate in history is one factor that is kind of contributing now to the kind of a growth in this history. Two, the influence of global warming, and that this is seen as an increasingly important thing to do for historical methodologies. And three, the availability of data makes it increasingly possible that you can do it now in a way that it probably wasn't in the 1980s and 1990s. That would be my suggestion, but I'd be open to some more suggestions in that regard.
Yes, this makes absolute perfect sense. And thank you for bringing all these strands of thinking together and explaining the integration of climate history into the Indian Ocean world history. We can now turn to the book and its 11 chapters. The book, the edited volume, moved geographically from China to Africa, and in periodization also from the 12th century to the 21st century. And in your introduction, you sketch this vast geography and periodization and introducing the subsequent volumes. Would you like to talk about the running themes across these chapters as you've edited the volume?
Sure, yeah. So I can talk, probably the easiest way to do that is to kind of discuss what I put in the call for chapters, actually. Basically, what I wanted to do is engage environmental historians, broadly conceived, who have analyzed droughts, floods, as singular events or as in a period of events over the long term. Want to engage them, and most, I think, and there are exceptions here, and that's definitely reflected in the author list, but most of them may have been familiar with a drought event in their particular region of study, which might be confined to, for example, China, might be confined to the Philippines, might be confined to East Africa. And what I wanted to do with them, and this is what I saw as my edited role, was to ask them to do that normal case study, inviting case studies. So what do you want to do? Do you want to study your drought? If you've studied a drought event, you see this having a massive effect on political stability, which would be the case for Gwyn Campbell's chapter on early 19th century Madagascar, or on food security, which would be the case for Teresa Ventura's chapter on the drought in the Philippines in 1911. Or on, for example, on epidemics, which comes through in my own chapter, and it comes through in Jim Warren's chapter as well. And then also on things like colonial science, which is, it comes through in a fascinating chapter by Fiona Williamson on colonial Singapore between 1877 and 1911. So I wanted to kind of invite scholars to, yes, identify their drought or identify their flood, and then to kind of use what they know of that drought or flood to kind of think about how it impacted other themes in their region's history. But then kind of what I saw my role as the editor was to do two kind of things with that. Is if there is a significant drought or flood in their region of study, there's a logic behind thinking of the Indian Ocean world as a connected space and connected by the Indian Ocean monsoon system thinking, is that if there's a massive drought in the Philippines triggered by a massive drought in the Philippines, for example, to take Teresa Ventura's chapter, chapter 11, is to think about, well, what underpinned that? And it looks like this is a significant, is triggered by El Nino. And then if it's triggered by El Nino, so where else may have been affected by it? If there's an El Nino triggered drought somewhere in the Indian Ocean world, it suggests that Indian Ocean monsoon system was also triggered, was also kind of made unstable by this broader global climatic event. And then so can we see where else may have been affected by this event as well? So that's kind of what I was asking what the Cool Papers was to really get to grips with your case study, and then we can work together to think about what the global climatic factors triggered that, whether it's El Nino, whether it's volcanic eruptions, whether it's a series of El Nino events, whether it's the Indian Ocean Dipole, whether it's all these things linked together in certain ways. And then more beyond that, if we can identify that potentially or suggest that trigger from a global climatic standpoint, can we kind of test that by looking at the expertise of other people involved in the project and knowing their kind of regional specializations? For example, Teresa Ventura's chapter, we're able to suggest that this El Nino event, which he focused on for the Philippines, also has a wider kind of context whereby drought also occurred in parts of the Indian subcontinent. There's above average rainfall in East Africa as well, just looking at the kind of rain gauge statistics. So that's kind of what the idea was that links them all together. Yes, so it's very much kind of started off with a case study that all of the authors would have been experts in already, simply because of their regions and time periods of specialism. Then the next step with all of those was to situate them in a wider global climatic context. I mean, what triggers these case studies from a climatic standpoint? Then also, if we can identify that or suggest an identification for that, can we then link it to abnormal climatic conditions elsewhere in the macro region as well, thereby giving a wider environmental and a wider spatial context for all the case studies that we analyzed? And the answer to that, I think we did that fairly successfully with all the chapters. A couple of them that really do stand out, however, I just want to draw your attention. Archisman Chowdhury's chapter, which focuses on the El Nino 1685 to 87. Now, he focuses on Golconda and the northern Coromandel coast in South Asia, and he links this El Nino event to famine, to drought, and then followed by floods. And he links it also to famine and to the spread, particularly of smallpox. Now, not only did he suggest ways in which there are other regions, particularly Southeast Asia, which experienced similar levels of drought as in the Coromandel coast, but he also therefore also suggested that the outbreak of smallpox on the Coromandel coast also that traveled to the Southeast Asia as well via the transport of enslaved people by the Dutch VOC. So not just by thinking about, so firstly, by thinking about the wider climatic context and the wider kind of spatial context in the Indian Ocean world, we also have some of the kind of the effects within these local case studies being spread over wider areas as well. And I think I'll leave it at that. I could list you some more, but I don't want to belabor the point.
Great. Thank you for this. I'm curious about the nature of sources by looking at or thinking about climate change and climate history. Some of the sources would be, let's say, more straightforward of, you know, documenting rainfall and weather patterns, and others wouldn't be straightforward, such as literary texts or inscriptions and so on. So how do you observe the differences in the nature of sources that these chapters are drawing on?
That's a very interesting question. And one of the things that I really like about climate history as I've got further and further into it is that it is incredibly interdisciplinary and is increasingly so. I think the individual authors could probably talk to their sources a lot better than I can. For my chapter myself, I relied on missionary sources for the most part. But the sources that really pervade a lot of the book, I wouldn't say the whole book, but a lot of it, are things like global climatic models and global climatic reconstructions. And things like drought atlases. Fiona Williamson's chapter draws on the Monsoon Asia Drought Atlas, for example. And these are natural, these, so as I'm sure a lot of listeners are aware of, like a lot of climate reconstructions use, for example, tree rings, ice cores, lake sediments, corals, to reconstruct and past climates. They've also been to suggest levels of rainfall at different times. So this is kind of looking at the natural world as a source, or analysis of natural phenomena as natural flora as a source. Now these now what happens if you put all this data together next to each other? You can kind of also reconstruct past climatic conditions in kind of a certain locale. But if there's a series of tree rings in a certain locale, then you can kind of maybe reconstruct past climatic conditions. But then you can also feed these into global climatic models. So even where there are maybe no natural proxy data or very limited amounts of natural proxy data, you might be able to suggest levels of rainfall and broader climatic conditions in those regions as well, by putting the kind of integrating them into wider drought atlases or climate reconstructions. So these are the kind of sources which I think are almost like the next stage in climate historical research that we started to engage with in this entered volume, and I think we're going to engage with more. In fact, I'm trying to do so right now, where the use of global climate simulations and reconstructions of the past kind of can suggest rainfall variability on fairly narrow scales. One such project, the 20th century reanalysis. So reanalysis is the process. So this is basically a product which suggests daily, in fact, but monthly is probably, so you can do it daily, but you can do it on monthly as well, climatic conditions over the entire world, which is just a degree of temporal resolution, which is just incredible. And it does that all the way back to 1836. Now, to the degree to which that is usable, those figures that they suggest are usable, particularly if they're not citing any kind of proxy material in the regions that you're studying, is there's a, probably a debate, a very large debate that still needs to be had about those uses and about their usability. But that's kind of, to answer your question, yeah, it's the interdisciplinary nature of climate history that I think this book reflects. And I think there are still more steps to go in that direction as well, which kind of incorporates these, interrogates, incorporates, and suggests ways of using these kind of global climatic models as a way of doing climate history.
Yes, that would be amazing if somebody would listen to us and take on this call to write us something reflecting on the nature of sources when it comes to reconstructing climate climate history. Let's now move to your chapter, NSO, IOD, Drought and Floods in Equatorial Eastern Africa between 1876 to 78. First, what is ENSO and IOD for our listeners, if you can briefly introduce them to these climatic phenomena? And what do you observe during the late 19th century Equatorial Eastern Africa that we should pay attention to and trying to understand the history of the region?
Sure, yeah. So ENSO, that's El Nino Southern Oscillation. So that's an anomaly of sea surface temperatures in the eastern equatorial Pacific Ocean, which was, I suppose, first discovered, I think, in the late 19th century as kind of a phenomenon, but as a phenomenon governing significant climatic variation. It was really, ENSO science really began from around the 1960s. And El Nino Southern Oscillation, so this is when sea surface temperatures are significantly above normal is an El Nino year. And when they're below normal is a La Nina year. We're talking about a positive anomaly. So when they're above normal for this case study that I'm doing here, and El Nino, so anomalies in the El Nino Southern Oscillation are the largest driver of interannual climate variability on a global scale. That's true in the past and it's true now. IOD is sometimes referred to as the Indian Nino, sometimes because it's occasionally seen as linked or triggered by El Nino, although that's still being interrogated. But the Indian Ocean Dipole is an anomaly of sea surface temperatures in the Indian Ocean. And a positive Indian Ocean dipole is when the western half of the Indian Ocean is significantly warmer than the eastern half. And a negative anomaly is the opposite way around, when the eastern half is warmer than the western half. Because of the process of convection, if there is an anomaly of Indian Ocean dipole, when there is an anomaly of Indian Ocean dipole, the areas around the warmer half of the Indian Ocean will receive significantly above average rainfall, and the areas on the colder half of the around the colder half of the Indian Ocean will receive below average rainfall. The most recent really significant example of this occurred in 2019, and keen listeners will probably remember some of the conditions in 2019. You'll probably be familiar with the serious bushfires in Australia. In 2019, so it's a positive Indian Ocean dipole. So there's lots of drought around the eastern half and a lot of above average rainfall in the western half. So there's serious bushfires in Australia, hit global headlines. And in the west, in the Arabian Peninsula, the Horn of Africa and parts of Eastern Africa, there are significant flooding events followed by massive locust infestations, which themselves were triggered by the flooding events. So that's what El Nino and Indian Ocean Dipole are. Now, in 1876 to 78, we have one of the largest events, positive El Nino events, occurred with one of the largest Indian Ocean positive Indian Ocean Dipole events. They occurred simultaneously, and they are some of the largest ever recorded. Scholars interested in this kind of temporality, the 1876 to 1878, may be familiar with these years as being a year of severe climatic stress in several parts of the Indian Ocean world, notably through the work of Mike Davis, his 2000 or 2001 celebrated book, Late Victorian Holocausts, which kind of identified it just as El Nino. He wrote just at a time when insulation dipoles only really being recognized by the scientific community as a driver of climate variability. So he only attributed to El Nino. It looks like there is significant interocean dipole anomalies as well. And there's also anomalies in the Atlantic as well, which I don't get into in this chapter, but which has been verified by climatologists since. And there have been scholars since Davis who have kind of identified abnormal climatic conditions across the Indian Ocean world. For example, Fiona Williamson's work on Singapore and the Malay Peninsula. And then there's some work done for northeastern and southeastern Africa as well. My contribution here is kind of fill in a gap. Equatorial Eastern Africa is the region that I was originally trained in, and I'd consulted the archives with the view to thinking, well, did East Africa experience these significant rainfall events? Did it have abnormal climatic conditions as well, simply because the rest of the Indian Ocean world, or large swathes of the Indian Ocean world, looks like there have been too? And the answer to that question was yes. That there were significantly weird climatic phenomena going on, which are recorded in the missionary archives. And it looks like from these missionary archives, the missionaries report on pretty severe drought in 1876, going into 1877, followed by severe flooding in certain regions in 1877-78. This is, broadly speaking, in line with what we'd expect as well. Climatological research, notably by Sharon Nicholson, she has investigated a lot about what the effects of El Nino and Indian Ocean Dipole are on East African climate. And yeah, broadly speaking, we'd expect there to be below-average rainfall in the year before the onset of El Nino conditions and significantly above average rainfall in the year of. And this really comes through in the missionary sources. Now, the missionaries themselves were only just entering the region at this time. So what they are commenting on, they didn't really understand. And a lot of what we kind of is only after, sometimes to some, they commented a lot on floods in 1877-78, which they really didn't expect. But it's also in years afterwards, they commented on they kind of reflected on kind of experiences of this year. And was like, yeah, that was really weird. We've never experienced that. We've not experienced that again. Like 1877-78 was a massively above average rainfall, or a lot more than we'd normally expect. So in kind of with this chapter, I went through the missionary archives, a mixture of the Church Missionary Society archives, the London Missionary Society archives, the White Fathers archives, and kind of identified their reports of below average rainfall and above average rainfall. I also put that into conversation with some monthly rain gauge data, which is being collected at the coast, at Mombasa and in Zanzibar too, just kind of to look at some broader regional variations to see how well they're supported. By kind of reconstructing where the most severe droughts or the most abundant flood or the largest inundations occurred, I kind of linked what these effects might have been on society. I kind of linked it to kind of three broad thematic phenomena. There looks like there have been some food shortages in the year of drought, particularly around Mpwapwa, which is just beyond the coastal hinterland. And there appears to have been late planting throughout the region because the rains arrived significantly late in 1876 too. Then after that, there appears to have been replanting in the year of floods because maybe the first planting were inundated and basically suffocated underwater. Then I also linked it to disease, thinking particularly to animal diseases, particularly bovine trypanosomiasis, otherwise known as sleeping sickness, which appears to have been epidemic during the year of floods in the coastal hinterland, and to possibly a higher severity of smallpox during the year of drought, as I think there's a bit of evidence to suggest that the that food shortages encourage people to travel in search of food and wages, and this may have pushed infected people to travel further, therefore making the epidemic spread further as well. And there seems to be correlation throughout the 1870s and 1880s that in the years of heightened drought or years when there's lesser rainfall, that smallpox does get reported on in the archive an awful lot more. And then the other one, which is a bit more speculative, I think, is I kind of suggested that the drought year also contributed to heightened levels of political instability, particularly on the fringes of some of the largest states, who, because of potentially low harvests, may have been in search of, may have gone in search of resources of kind of neighboring regions in order to feed their political centers. So that's kind of, it's kind of very exploratory in some ways, thinking about some of the broad themes of what we think climatic variability can be linked to, which kind of pervade the whole book as well, and kind of tracing them in the missionary archive to see the extent to which they occurred. I identified the climatic conditions, then kind of explored the ways in which that they might have affected states and societies in the region, particularly focusing on food security, disease, and political instability.
Mm-hmm. I would like to connect this chapter to your recently published monograph on the frontiers of the Indian Ocean world, a history of Lake Tanganyika, published by Cambridge University Press last year. And I would like to ask you this provocation, which is, if we would take climate history and environmental history out of your historical analysis of the lake, what would we miss in our historical understanding? Or let's say, what would it add to our understanding if we were to include climate history in our historical analysis of the region?
I think it just gives us. Yeah, it does. So, as you're aware, so chapter two of my book on the frontiers of the Indian Ocean world does engage with climate history, and it does mention this 1876-78 event, though in nowhere near as in depth, and focusing only pretty much on Ujiji and the wider region around Lake Tanganyika, whereas this has a much wider geographical scope, incorporating the coastal hinterland, Buganda, present day in central Tanzania as well. And what it kind of does, I think it just gives a deeper context to kind of the broader themes that are known from East African history. So from this, so it's well known even from the works published in 1960s and 1970s, when African history is really starting to become a respected and established field within global university institutions, that the 19th century was a period of massive political economic change, principally through growing strategies of state building and through the connections between inland East Africa with the wider global economy, principally through the global expansion of the global ivory trade, where the tusks of East African elephants were particularly demanded in the industrializing North America and industrializing Europe. But one of the things that I think is kind of missed from a focus on just on state building and on this kind of global economic change is the fact that most people in East Africa remained as farmers. Now, this does not mean that but on top of that, though, but farming didn't stay constant throughout this period. The new crops were added, maize, rice, cassava, entered inland regions in significant quantities for the first time during this period. And these are potentially high yield crops. But maize and rice in particular, which are possible staples, have less resistance to water stress, which means can potentially increase drought vulnerability of societies. So what I think you get from adding kind of the climate perspective is actually you get a sense of the context that affects most of the people in the region, and a sense of the factors that actually underpin the region's economies. Agriculture, and in some of the arid regions, pastoralism remains the backbone of the economy. So there if you really want to understand that, I think you really do need to understand the climatic context. And I think you need to particularly do so as the, further and further on in the 19th century, when states get larger, when settlements get larger, so they're relying on a larger supply of food around, food from kind of around these political centers and urban commercial centers as well. You also, and also in the context of the fact that a lot of farmers are growing crops which are potentially higher yield, but also have less resistance to water stress. So that's what you, I think you get a lot. Yes, you get a lot from climate history in terms of understanding the functioning of the kind of the backbone of the states, the things that keep them going on a day-to-day basis outside of kind of the global economic factors, such as the connections to the world economy. The other thing which I think is important to note here that I think still needs some more research, and particularly nuanced research is actually required, and it's something that I'm wrestling with, is that some of these things that we associate with the spread of global capitalism is kind of the degeneration of environments, particularly including in the Indian Ocean world. And you kind of see kind of as a result of the need to produce kind of cash crops quickly, crops for sales and not so increasingly commercialized agriculture, as opposed to an agriculture that prioritizes profit over survival. And this is kind of a feature of the spread of capitalism in the Indian Ocean world. And I think India is probably the case studies that really come through to that. And I'd kind of refer you to kind of the work of Vinita Damodaran on that front. But one of the things that I really do, and that's very much associated with also the spread of colonialism at the same time, what I'm kind of observing here is actually there's actually quite similar patterns occurring in East Africa during the 19th century through the spread of the integration of the region with with the growing capitalist economy at this time provokes certain changes in the agricultural regimes that basically service capitalism in the way that they feed caravans, they feed commercial centers, they feed states which exploit the global ivory trade. And this comes to the detriment of food security for large swathes of the population in periods of climatic stress. Now, this kind of gives kind of an agentive, this kind of in some ways gives agency to a lot of agency for structures emanating from the global north and from the metropoles where capitalism is being spread from. So from the UK, from the United States. And this kind of goes contrary to a lot of what Africanist historical research has been since the 1960s, which is to basically understand African history in its own right. To get out of Eurocentric paradigms where you focus on local agency, local revolutions, the local drivers of state building, local drivers of economic change and how they responded in, I suppose, ways that are not cogent with what capitalism would expect, because these are distinctly local responses. You don't want to smooth out these overall, you don't want to smooth out vast differences across between Europe and Africa. And one of the things I'm really wrestling with here, which I think requires more research, and I think comes from bringing in the environment and the environmental context into it, is that we're kind of seeing, actually, you know, there is a significant kind of European, or at least capitalistic influence on East Africa during the 19th century, which needs to be unpicked. One of the, because the way that I'm kind of framing this is how do you conceptualize African agency or African autonomy within the context of growing European capitalist hegemony, even if that doesn't seem to be direct on East Africa at the same time in the 19th century. What I'm exploring at the moment, what you get from studying the environmental context, is need to wrestle with that question more. And I think that's where something that I'm kind of wrestling with now and hope to continue to do so in the future.
Thank you for that. Can you say something about who would you hope will read this book and what sort of impact would you like it to have?
Yes. So I think this book is mostly for academics. I'd love to say that it has a really wide readership, for undergraduates. It probably doesn't, except in a methods course, which would talk about climate history as method and the ways you can incorporate diverse source types. For example, you alluded to a couple, like with carvings and art history, but also the ones I mentioned too, like global climatic models and how you can integrate those as series. So in maybe an environment, so a methods course in history would be a way that it could be integrated into an undergraduate reading list. But other than that, I think it's mostly experts in climate history, and it is mostly interesting. I think this gives kind of a nice overview of the possibilities for kind of specialists in East African history. Late 19th century East African history would be interested to read my take on the late 1870s and Stephen Rockall's take on the 1880s. And then specialists in China, in the history of China, would want to read, I'd expect, would be very interested in Sylvia Ebner von Eschenbach's chapter and Angela Schottenhout's chapter. So there's kind of, I think most readings of it will be on a chapter by chapter basis for people interested in particular regions within the Indian Ocean world. It's people who are, for scholars mostly, who are interested in climate history and the practice of climate history and how you can go about doing it. And also the other group would be Indian Oceanist historians and how you understand the Indian Ocean and Indian Ocean world as a connected space. I think quite a lot of the connections are kind of conceived in terms of cultural connections and economic connections through physical lines of connection by oceanic trade and oceanic migrations. I think there's other connections to draw out here, particularly with the collective experiences of the Indian Ocean monsoon system and anomalies and variations therein. So yeah, I think it's mostly going to be experts, academics who are going to be engaged with the book as a whole. But then the introduction in terms of methods could be interesting to undergraduate students in a methods course. And then obviously kind of a regional specialization, each chapter kind of contributes to its own regional historiography very well, I think.
Yeah, I think it would really be useful for students, especially because every chapter ends with a bibliography of the archival sources and the published and unpublished sources, which are really useful, as well as maps and figures and charts and tables that historians and other researchers can use as a source of their data. Philip, we've taken a lot of your time. So thank you so much for your generous answers. You've mentioned a little bit about what you're wrestling with now. Is that what you're working on now? Would you like to say something about your current or future projects?
Sure, thanks. Yes, my current research is basically climate history of East Africa. And I've kind of alluded to a lot of what I'm doing or trying to do now throughout in some of my answers. But my current project is one that is funded by SHRC, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, investigating climate history and human environment interaction in equatorial Eastern Africa, circa 1750 to 1900. And the idea here is kind of similar with this edited volume, is to kind of write a climate history of the region, firstly by reconstructing past climates using a variety of sources, and then using that kind of new climate archive is what I'm kind of clawing. I'm trying to create basically an archive that uses climate models, documentary sources, climate reanalysis, global circulation models, local proxy records in like lake sediments, tree rings from just outside the region, coral records from in the Indian Ocean itself, to kind of make a reconstruct climate for the period 1750 to 1900. Some of the early periods I'm kind of doing on a decadal scale. Some of the later periods we'll be doing on a monthly scale. We're probably limit for the purpose of analysis. Meaningful analysis will be basically on a seasonal scale, and basically creating this kind of climate archive using all these diverse source types as a basis to reinterpret East African history focusing principally on the major state building zones in that region during the late 18th to 19th centuries, which is inland central Tanzania around the Unyamwezi kingdoms, and then also in Buganda in present day Uganda, and kind of assess the ways in which variable climatic conditions influence the growth of states during this period in those two zones over the 19th century, over the 18th and 19th centuries. I'm in the process of, I've done most of the research for that. I'm in the process of trying to write it up. And hopefully there'll be a book proposal going out before the end of the year. And then we'll start possibly trying to, well, get it finished.
I look forward to that and best of luck with drafting the book. Thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your insights and thoughts about climate history and the Indian Ocean. And thank you for the listeners for listening to today's episode, in which we explored droughts, floods, and global climatic anomalies in the Indian Ocean world, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2022. This is your host, Ahmed Elmazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.